Jen says in her book, in order to reject patriarchal thinking, we must be able to distinguish between it and something else, an alternative. This is what I'm trying to do. She says we should try to think outside patriarchy, but I feel we also have to think inside patriarchy, because if not, we don't understand it. I never understood patriarchy. This is why I started to study it, and I just founded the Innsbruck Institute for Research on Patriarchy, because, and also I hope, as Jen said, she was never inside the academics, that she remained naive. And I, even though I have been inside the academic world for much time, I hope to have remained naive too, in a way. I hope so, at least. So I don't have to add anything to the gift paradigm, but I have to add something to the analysis of patriarchy. A radically worldview is possible, and I think also a radically different world is possible, not only the view, but the world as such. Therefore, my analysis turns around capitalist patriarchy and the struggle for a deep alternative. I think that this different worldview is necessary because today we are observing a global social, economical, ecological, and political development that is totally different from what it is supposed to be. The so-called globalization, obviously, is not a movement towards more democracy, peace, general welfare, wealth, and ecological sustainability, as it propagators are pretending everywhere. On the contrary, the opposite is true. Never in history have so many people died from hunger and thirst, environmental destruction and war, most of them women and children. Never in history has the technological process led to such an intense and threatening destruction of the environment globally. Never in history has the nuclear threat been so acute. Never in history have the political systems been changing so clearly into the direction of an authoritarian, if not despotic, rule in many parts of the world. And never in history has such a tiny minority on the globe been so incredibly rich and powerful, like the transnational corporations and their global players of today, for whom we and the planet are nothing else but their play material. In sum, this situation can be called the development of underdevelopment, but this time underdevelopment is not only produced in the South but also in the North. It is the result of a new colonization of the world, which did and does not happen inexplicably, but is actively and aggressively promoted by the governments as their general and apparently normal policy, beginning in the 80s of the 20th century. This policy consists in a continuing process of primitive accumulation that leads to forced economic growth through the direct expropriation of the peoples of the globe and the globe itself. The name of this policy is neoliberalism, and this new liberalism fits exclusively to the interests of the corporations. For the rest of humanity, it means just the opposite, namely totalitarianism. Is this new world order the best of all possible worlds that Western civilization pretends to develop? Or is the current development of Western civilization the peak and turning point towards its final decline? Meanwhile, many people have made a description of the situation and its dynamics. There, it seems to be no future astonishingly enough even for the global players themselves. I call this situation West End in process. The self-given license to loot the resources of the earth will find an end with the end of the resources already underway, and the resource wars, the new wars on the globe for oil and water that have already begun, are just a logical consequence. But there is nearly no deeper analysis of the reasons that are leading to this extraordinary situation and its dynamics that seem to exclude any alternative. There is no real explanation of the world's dilemma and its causes that is deep enough. I suppose that the reasons why most people do not really know why all these things are happening is due to the fact that the left as well as the right and the sciences in general have never analyzed patriarchy. And not knowing patriarchy also means not really knowing capitalism, because the two do not only share a time of being together on this earth for now 500 years, but of being deeply related to each other in a way that has not been understood by most people until today, even feminists. Therefore, it is time to do the necessary step, analyzing capitalist patriarchy from its roots and as a theoretical concept for the analysis of society. Only then it can be seen that patriarchy is much more than just a word for polemical purposes, but it can be understood as a concept that explains the character of the whole social order in which we are living today. Recent studies of matriarchal societies suggest mainly three things. First, patriarchal society as we know it did not exist as such and independently from or even before the matriarchal one, but started to develop after the armed invasion, violent conquest, and systematic destruction of matriarchal society by armed hordes that had lost their own originally matriarchal culture after having been exposed to catastrophic migration. This process is reported from the 5th millennium before Christ onwards, and it occurred in China, India, the Middle East, North and Central Africa, Europe, and the Americas as well. As patriarchal society did not exist as such, we have to analyze the conditions that led to its development. The development of patriarchal society is related to the invention of something that from then on was called war. And the development of patriarchy has been dependent on the continuation of war, even in so-called peace times. Otherwise, the people of the conquered communities and societies would have easily liberated themselves from the conqueror's rule. The logic of patriarchy since then is the logic of war, which means that all the social institutions invented by patriarchy are principally drawn from war experiences. A, patriarchy invented a political system based on the invention of the state, which meant the hierarchical dominance of armed men over the conquered people and the dominance of men over women, because women were at the center of pre-patriarchal society and felt responsible for the maintenance of its egalitarian principles. B, patriarchy invented an economy based on the invention of the plunder of other people's property, from then on called private property, from privare, that means to rob, and on an always more systematical exploitation of the conquered through exchange, all of which caused the impoverishment, especially of the women, because women had control over the means of production, were the producers, distributors, and givers of concrete wealth, namely life, food, security, and the integration of everybody into the community. C. Patriarchy invented a society split into social classes, races, generations, and genders. What meant from then on, especially women, were regarded as being subjected to men by nature in order to never be able again to reestablish a matriarchal society. D. Patriarchy invented a godfather or male creator religion based on the image of the great warrior, plunderer, proprietor, or big man who was regarded to be able and to be legitimized to give and to take life like the great mother or goddess herself, replacing her by the idea or ideology of an omnipotent, violent, and jealous single god, a sort of an abstract patriarchal mother-father. E. Patriarchy invented a technology based on the war as the father of all things, namely by beginning to transform the pre-patriarchal technique and philosophy of alchemy into a patriarchal one, what meant that from then on, men systematically tried to use the existing female knowledge about life and nature in order to appropriate it, to pervert it into a means of control over life and nature, and finally to overcome the dependence on nature and women by trying to replace them through technological progress, the project of a sort of second creation. And F, patriarchy invented a psychology that defined the ways how men could develop their masculation, as Jen says, their competitive patriarchal egological individuality, opposing women, the community, and nature. In sum, the patriarchal order of society meant a total break with matriarchal or gift-giving social rules, traditions, and taboos from times immemorial and can be defined as a war system in development. And even if there have been times and spaces that did not fit at all into this picture, the development or so-called evolution, namely that of patriarchy, nevertheless, in the last instances, has been a continuous one. and women did not prevent patriarchy from developing further until today. Second definition, part of definition of defining patriarchy. In patriarchal societies, we can always find rests of the former matriarchal ones that is called matriarchy as second culture, left over or newly reorganized after the patriarchs had started to negate the reality and quality of matriarchal society. This second culture can be observed everywhere, for example, in mother-child relationships, in love, or generally in gift-giving. It contradicts the patriarchal order, but also helps it to exist because a society without any matriarchal relations could simply not survive. Therefore, patriarchies are always somehow mixed societies, be it to a higher or lower degree, and they, for obvious reasons, are hiding this fact as much as they can. But today, it can be observed very clearly that patriarchy is trying to complete its negation of matriarchy in order to replace it as much as possible. This destruction and the fading away of the second culture in patriarchy, it could be argued, is one of the main reasons for the depth of the crisis of the contemporary civilization. The negation of matriarchy as such consisted and consists in presupposing that there has never been any matriarchal society, that patriarchal society existed from the beginning of human life on earth, and or pretending that a violent and evil rule of women had to be broken before patriarchal society could develop so-called civilization and progress. Due to this patriarchal mythology, most people today still think that matriarchy did never exist, or that it meant rule of women instead of rule of men, which indeed never was the case in matriarchal, but maybe sometimes in patriarchal society. So most people do not understand that the terms matriarchy and patriarchy are not just referring to men and women, or male and female, but to the character of the whole social order, so that both men and women living in matriarchy have to be considered matriarchal, and living in patriarchy both have to be considered principally patriarchal, referring to their thinking, acting, and feeling. Furthermore, the negation of matriarchy consisted and consists in destroying the matriarchal society as a social order on its own, appropriating everything from matriarchal society that seemed important to the patriarchs, trying to usurp it, especially the image and the abilities of the mother and the goddess, because patriarchy did not have an originally own culture, and perverting everything matriarchal into its opposite, which is the way how the patriarchal is defined. Then, trying to transform the originally matriarchal society into a patriarchal one by developing the policies of divide and rule, by dissolving and abstracting the interconnectedness of people, communities, and nature in general, and by subsequently trying to replace them by a purely patriarchal world. Especially this last question, namely of the transformation and substitution of nature, women, and their social order, have nearly never been regarded in their crucial importance. Third part of definition of patriarchy. People's experiences with patriarchal society, war, despotic rule, and ceaseless violence logically led to a complete change in the general worldview too. The Gnostic worldview appeared. Gnosis means recognition. It is recognized that the world is bad, evil, low, primitive, violent, sinful, and not worth living in it. A better, higher, more developed, noble, and civilized world, therefore, is becoming the ideal of people in patriarchy. But it is believed that this higher world cannot be found on earth, less in the matriarchal past or presence elsewhere. So the higher world is thought of as a metaphysical world that can only be envisioned by imagination. A metaphysical world beyond physics was not thought of in matriarchal society because the words mater and archi together do not mean rule of mothers, but in the beginning the mother. Life stems from mothers, uterus. Therefore, life, death, the mother and the goddess are always here in this world, and they all belong to each other, so that there is neither the need nor the idea of another metaphysical world beyond the one in which we are living every day. In patriarchal society, on the contrary, another world beyond the existing one has to be invented, because the words pater and archi together do not simply mean rule of fathers, Heide, was she, but in the beginning a so-called father. a word unknown in matriarchal times, by the way, or life stems from fathers instead of from mothers. Fathers are men with uteruses who, in the last instance, are able to give life themselves without needing women at all. For example, the pharaoh Echnaton, for example, made himself be painted as a pregnant man. Only on the basis of this fantasy, men would be legitimized to rule over those who are not fathers, that is, the people and especially the mothers. The father, therefore, is defined as somebody who is a ruling man and as such not only able to take life, but also to give life. In patriarchy, the words archi, the word archi thus did not only mean beginning, origin, uterus, but also rule and domination too. The second meaning of archi did not appear before patriarchy, so that in matriarchy, archi could never have meant domination, much less mothers or women's rule. There simply was no domination, and therefore there was no word for it. This means that the political system of patriarchal society can be regarded as a first step into the direction of the development of a pure, fully realized patriarchy in which the fathers would be men with uteruses or with something like uterus machines. So the political system of patriarchy would only be needed as a method for the period in which patriarchy moves towards its realization, in which it is on its way towards a real patriarchy conceived of as the end of history. From this point of view, history is only the time in which patriarchy appeared and developed until it became 100% reality. The patriarchal usurpation, destruction, and perversion of the mother and the wish to replace her thus led to an early sort of science fiction, namely to the idea that what is only and absurdly supposed, namely that life stems from the father and not from the mother, is considered even more real than what can be experienced every day, namely the opposite. Gnostic metaphysics and the belief in it as another higher reality are appearing everywhere, in every theological as well as philosophical tradition until today. Since then, belief has become more important than knowledge, even more so in the secularized modern sciences of today. In sum, the historically new concept of the father is a triple fiction. It imitates the fiction of a powerful patriarchal mother or goddess and imagines to have successfully replaced her. This way, the father is defined as a sort of patriarchal mother, the god as a sort of patriarchal goddess, who, as a complete antagonism, could never before have been thought of. But the fiction is program. The idea of patriarchy has become its political and technological project. Patriarchy as a society in which life stems from fathers and not from mothers has to be artificially produced or it will never exist. The project is life, or what is considered to be life, should be born or be made by men. So only when men have become real fathers, patriarchal society would, in the long run, not have to fear women and matriarchy or the gift paradigm as another alternative any longer. Now I have to be very short. So having defined patriarchy this way, what does it mean for defining capitalism? From my analysis of patriarchy follows that capitalism is nothing else but the latest stage of patriarchy. My hypothesis is that patriarchy crystallizes into capitalism. This means that with capitalism, there is a break with as well as a continuation of patriarchy, both even going to the same direction, namely fostering patriarchy. The logics of patriarchy led straightforward into the modern epoch because capitalism is the promise to finally realize the futuristic Gnostic utopia materially and on earth. It consists in the intent to produce a purely patriarchal society, cleaned from matriarchal rests whatsoever, and propagated as a man-made perfect second paradise. Metaphysics are to become the new physics. This is the propaganda of modern society as a whole. This is the beginning of the great transformation for which modern Europe has become so famous. The idea is that what we can see today everywhere, that nature, women, and their order has to be replaced by the artificial products of industry, namely gifts by exchange, subsistence by commodities, foreign cultures by Western culture, concrete wealth by money, machinery, and capital, the new abstract wealth, living labor by machines, the brain by artificial intelligence, women by sex machines, real mothers by mother machines, and life in general by artificial life, like genetically modified organisms, and generally by what I call the alchemical system of an industrial life production. Therefore, the so-called technological progress through the development of modern sciences and the invention of the machine as a totally new techno-system has been the logical backbone of modern patriarchal epoch. And the invention of the prophet that could be drawn out of this adventure of transformation of the whole world has convinced always more people, mostly men. But with all this progress, as we know, Mother Earth is going to be more and more destroyed. We know that nuclear and genetic changes are already irreversible. So capitalism, with its activism, optimism, positivism, rationality, and its irrational belief in violence, is not just capitalism, but has to be defined as capitalist patriarchy. But if the matter of capitalism, its matter, its mothers, its women, its patriarchal rests do not obey anymore, and if nature does not as well, only then will capitalist patriarchy be disappearing. And as capitalist patriarchy is obviously not a society for eternity, this is going to happen now. So patriarchal institutions will have to be deconstructed. The metaphysical Gnostic worldview, its religion, materialism, and idealism will have to be given up. Instead, the interconnectedness of life has to be recognized as the basis for a post-patriarchal spirituality. Economic and technological progress cannot be defined as having to produce value or profit and machinery as substitutes for life, nature, and women any longer. The paradise that is supposed to be invented is already here. It is our Earth herself, the most wonderful living planet in the universe. Accepting this, we suddenly will have to do a lot in order to prevent this still existing paradise from disappearing forever. For example, the Congo, as the World Bank has started to cut the jungles in the heart of Africa, we have to become active in order to stop this destruction of a whole continent. Men and women have to liberate themselves from the idea and the delusion that life on Earth is unimportant, a mere illusion, Maya, and something that has to be or can be replaced by something else. They have to learn lessons of nature again. We will have to know instead of believe. We will have to learn that destruction does not lead to a better world, but to destruction. We will have to learn that there is no truth in violence. We will have to learn that there is no happiness in egotism, and so on. And last but not least, what is needed is a reversion of a perverted, parasitic society and mankind, the patriarchal mother-father, as a cyborg that is the alchemical materialization of a metaphysical fiction, has to fade away as soon as possible. Thank you.
You've been listening to Dr. Claudia von Werlhoff, Professor of Women's Studies and Political Science at the University of Innsbruck, Austria, speaking at a 2004 conference on the theory of the gift economy.
First you told Sony, through you could we know God, and if we dared to question, then he wouldn't spare the rod. For you we worked the soil, for you we dug the moors, for you we shed our blood, fought so many pointless wars. And now you build your fences and you say there's nothing we can do. You say the world around us belongs fairly to the few, but about 6 billion people no doubt will agree this world is our home, not your property. It's the commons, our right of birth. And you would enclose the land all around the earth. Our future is your downfall when we cut this ball and chain. You who'd sacrifice the public good for your private gain. With our sweat we built the railroads, built cities on these shores. But because you own the money, to say that it's all yours. We laid the phone lines and the pipelines, and then right before our eyes, you see these things our taxes paid for. You now will privatize. Privatize the hospitals, privatize the schools, privatize the prisons for all those who break your rules. And preparing for the day when all the wells run dry, you say you own the very rain that falls down from the sky. But it's the commons, our right of birth, and you who'd own the water all around the earth. Our future is your downfall when we cut this ball and chain. You who'd sacrifice the public good for your private gain. You claim to own the harvest with your Terminator seeds. You claim to own the genome of every animal that breeds. You claim to own our culture and the music that we play. And with each song that we download, to your coffers we must pay. You'd even own my name, and yet say it's for the best. Maybe you'll let us on your radio if our songs can pass your test. You own country, you own western, you say you've given us a choice. You may own the airwaves, but you'll never own my voice. It's the commons, our right of birth, and you who'd own the music all around the earth. Our future is your downfall when we cut this ball and chain. You who'd sacrifice the public good for your private gain. It's the commons, our right of birth, and you who would own everything all around the earth. Our future is your downfall when we cut this ball and chain. You who'd sacrifice the public good for your private gain.
The Commons by David Rovics, and you can find his freely available music on the web at davidrovics.com. Spelled R-O-V-I-C-S. We'll conclude the program by beginning a new chapter in our ongoing reading, John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of American Education. Gatto is certainly not an advocate of the gift economy, and in fact, the term cooperation has been used in his writings in a specific and negative sense to refer to corporate monopolies driving out the small business and family farm-based economy, which he sees as essential to the realization of the American democratic ideal. His book is basically an analysis of compulsory schooling as an ideological tool to shape America into a centrally controlled, class-stratified society suitable to the needs of a mass production consumption economy. His work resonates with the prior material in that he identifies the family and the community as oppositional institutions to this arrangement. So this is Chapter 13, The Empty Child. Gatto writes, "At the university, people used to call King's College before the American Revolution. I lived for a time under a psychological regime called behaviorism, in the last golden moments before mind science took over American schooling. At Columbia, I was in on the transformation without ever knowing it. By the time it happened, I had shape-shifted into a schoolteacher, assigned to spend my adult life as a technician in the human rat cage we call public education. Although I may flatter myself for one brief instant, I think I was the summer favorite of Dr. Fred S. Keller at Columbia, a leading behaviorist of the late 1950s whose own college textbook was dedicated to his mentor, B.F. Skinner, the most famous of all behaviorists from Harvard. Skinner was then rearing his own infant daughter in a closed container with a window, much like keeping a baby in an aquarium, a device somehow misdescribed in the famous article, Baby in a Box, published in the Ladies' Home Journal, September 28, 1945. Italian parents giving their own children a glass of wine in those days might have ended up in jail and their children in foster care. But what Skinner did was perfectly legal. For all I know, it still is. What happened to Miss Skinner? Apparently, she was eventually sent to a famous progressive school, the very opposite of a rat conditioning cage, and grew up to be an artist. Speaking of boxes, Skinner commanded boxes of legal tender, lecturing and consulting with business executives on the secrets of mass behavior he had presumably learned by watching trapped rats. From a marketing standpoint, the hardest task the rising field of behavioral psychology had in peddling its wares was masking its basic stimulus-response message, albeit one with a tiny twist, in enough different ways to justify calling behaviorism a school. Fat consultancies were beginning to be available in the post-war years, but the total lore of behaviorism could be learned in about a day, so its embarrassing thinness required fast footwork to conceal. Being a behaviorist, then, would hardly have taxed the intellect of a parking lot attendant. It still doesn't. In those days, the U.S. government was buying heavily into these not-so-secret secrets, as if anticipating that needy moment, scheduled to arrive at the end of the 20th century, when Richard Barnett of the Institute for Policy Studies would write to Harper's in a voice freighted with doom, quote, "The problem is starkly simple. An astonishingly large and increasing number of human beings are not needed or wanted to make the goods or provide the services that paying customers of the world can afford," close quote. In the decades prior to this Malthusian assessment, a whole psychological institute for social cookery sprang up like a toadstool in the United States to offer recipe books for America's future. Even then, they knew that 80% of the next generation was neither needed nor wanted. Remedies had to be found to dispose of the menace psychologically. Skinner had wonderful recipes, better than anyone's. Not surprisingly, his procedures possessed a vague familiarity to readers listed in the Blue Book or the Social Register, people whose culture made them familiar with the training of dogs and falcons. Skinner had recipes for bedwetting, for interpersonal success, for management of labor, for hugging, for decision-making. His industrial group prepackaged hypotheses to train anyone for any situation. By 1957, his machines constituted the psychological technology of choice in institutions with helpless populations. Juvenile detention centers, homes for the retarded, homes for wayward mothers, adoption agencies, orphan asylums. Everywhere, the image of childhood was most debased. The pot of gold at the end of Skinner's rainbow was school. Behaviorism's main psychological rival in 1957 was psychoanalysis. But this rival had lost momentum by the time big government checks were available to buy psychological services. There were many demerits against psychoanalysis. Its primitive narrative theory, besides sounding weird, had a desperate time proving anything statistically. Its basic technique required simple data to be elaborated beyond the bounds of credibility. Even where that was tolerable, it was useless in a modern school setting built around a simulacrum of precision in labeling. Social learning theorists, many academic psychiatrists, anthropologists, or other specialists identified with a university or famous institution like the Mayo Clinic were behaviorism's closest cash competition. But behind the complex exterior webs they wove about social behavior, all were really behaviorists at heart. Though they spun theory in the mood of Rousseau, the payoff in each case came down to selling behavioral prescriptions to the policy classes. Their instincts might lead them into lyrical flights that could link rock falls in the Crab Nebula to the falls of sparrows in Monongahela, but the bread-and-butter argument was that mass populations could be and should be controlled by the proper use of carrots and sticks. Another respectable rival for the crown behaviorism found itself holding after World War II was stage theory, which could vary from the poetic grammar of Erik Erikson to the impenetrable mathematical tapestry of Jean Piaget, an exercise in chutzpah weaving the psychological destiny of mankind out of the testimony of less than 24 bourgeois Swiss kids. Modest academic empires could be erected on allegiance to one stage theory or another, but there were so many they tended to get in each other's way. Like seven-step programs to lose weight and keep it off, stage theory provided friendly alternatives to training children like rats. But the more it came into direct competition with the misleading precision of Skinnerian psychology, the sillier its clay feet looked. All stage theory is embarrassingly culture-bound. Talk about the attention span of kids, and suddenly you are forced to confront the fact that while 18-month-old Americans become restless after 30 seconds, Chinese of that age can closely watch a demonstration for 5 minutes. And while 8-year-old New Yorkers can barely tie their shoes, 8-year-old Amish put in a full workday on the family homestead. Even in a population apparently homogeneous, stage theory can neither predict nor prescribe for individual cases. Stage theories sound right for the same reason astrological predictions do, but the disconnect between ideal narratives and reality becomes all too clear when you try to act on them. When stage theory was entering its own golden age in the late 1960s, behaviorism was already entrenched as the psychology of choice. The federal government's B-Step document and many similar initiatives to control teacher preparation had won the field for the stimulus response business. So much money was pouring into psychological schooling from government corporate sources, however, that rat psychologists couldn't absorb it all. A foot-in-the-door opportunity presented itself, which stage theorists scrambled to seize. The controlling metaphor of all scientific stage theories is not like behaviorisms that people are built like machinery, but that they grow like vegetables. Kinder requires garden, an easy sell to people sick of being treated like machinery. For all its seeming humanitarianism, stage theory is just another way to look beyond individuals to social class abstractions. If nobody possesses a singular spirit, then nobody has a sovereign personal destiny. Mother Teresa, Tolstoy, Hitler, they don't signify for stage theory, though from time to time they are asked to stand as representatives of types. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. To understand empty child theory, you have to visit with behaviorists. Their meal ticket was hastily jerry-built by the advertising agency guru John Watson and by Edward Lee Thorndike, founder of educational psychology. Watson's Behaviorist Manifesto of 1913 promoted the then novel utilitarian psychology whose, quote, theoretical goal is the prediction and control of behavior, close quote. Like much that passes for wisdom on the collegiate circuit, their baby was stitched together from the carcasses of older ideas. Behaviorism, Thorndike's version, stillborn, was called connectionism. It was a purified hybrid of Wilhelm Wundt's laboratory at Leipzig and Comte's positivism broadcast in the pragmatic idiom of the Scottish common sense philosophers. We needn't trace all the dead body parts pasted together to sigh at the claim of an originality which isn't there. Reminiscent of Howard Gardner's fashion as seer of multiple intelligence theory, an idea as ancient as the pyramids. Behaviorists read entrails. They spy on the movements of trapped and hopeless animals, usually rats or pigeons. This gives an advantage over other psychologists of standing on a pile of animal corpses as the emblem of their science. The study of learning is their chief occupation. How rats can be driven to run in a maze or press a bar with a proper schedule of reward and punishment. Almost from the start, they abjured the use of the terms reward and punishment, concluding that these beg the question. Who is to say what is rewarding except the subject? And the subject tells us more credibly with his future behavior than with his testimony. You can only tell whether a reward is truly rewarding from watching future behavior. This accurate little semantic curveball allows a new discipline to grow around the terms positive reinforcement, reward, and negative reinforcement, punishment. Behavior to behaviorists is only what can be seen and measured. There is no inner life. Skinner added a wrinkle to the simpler idea of Pavlovian conditioning, from which subsequent libraries of learned essays have been written, when he stated that the stimulus for behavior is usually generated internally. In his so-called operant conditioning, the stimulus is thus written with a small s rather than with a Pavlovian capital S. So what? Just this. Skinner's lowercase internal s leaves a tiny hole for the ghost of free will to sneak through. Despite the furor this created in the world of academic psychology, the tempest in a teapot nature of lowercase uppercase stimuli is revealed from Skinner's further assertion that these mysterious internal stimuli of his can be perfectly controlled by manipulating exterior reinforcements according to proper schedules. In other words, even if you do have a will, not certain, your will is still perfectly programmable. You can be brought to love Big Brother all the same. The way I came to the attention of Dr. Keller's teaching assistants was by writing a program to cause co-eds to surrender their virginity behaviorally without realizing they had been scored with an operant conditioning program. My blueprint delighted the assistants. Copies were prepared and sent informally to other colleges. One went, I believe, to Skinner himself. When I look back on my well-schooled self, who played this stupid prank, I'm disgusted. But it should serve as a warning of how an army of grown-up children was and still is encouraged to experiment on each other as a form of higher-level modern thinking. An entire echelon of management has been trained in the habit of scientific pornography. Caught by the title of the Cole Porter song, anything goes. Behaviorism has no built-in moral breaks to restrain it other than legal jeopardy. You hardly have to guess how irresistible this outlook was to cigarette companies, proprietary drug purveyors, market researchers, hustlers of white bread, bankers, stock salesmen, makers of extruded plastic knickknacks, sugar brokers, and, of course, men on horseback and heads of state. A short time after I began as a behaviorist, I quit, having seen enough of the ragged Eichmannist crew at Columbia drawn like iron filings to this magnetic program, which promised to simplify all the confusion of life into underlying schemes of reinforcement. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. The worm lives in our initial conception of human nature. Are human beings to be trusted? With what reservations? To what degree? The official answer lately has been not much, at least since the end of World War II. Christopher Lash was able to locate some form of surveillance, apprehension, confinement or other security procedure at the bottom of more than one-fifth of the jobs in the United States. Presumably, that's because we don't trust each other. Where could that mistrust have been learned? As we measure each other, we select a course to follow. A curriculum is a race course. How we lay it out is contingent on assumptions we make about the horses and spectators. So it is with school. Are children empty vessels? What do you think? I suspect not many parents look at their offspring as empty vessels because contradictory evidence accumulates from birth. But the whole weight of our economy and its job prospects is built on the outlook that people are empty, or so plastic, it's the same thing. The commodification of childhood, making it a product which can be sold, demands a psychological frame in which kids can be molded. A handful of philosophers dominates modern thinking because they argue this idea, and in arguing it, they open up possibilities to guide history to a conclusion in some perfected society. Are children empty? John Locke said they were in his essay concerning human understanding, quote, "Let us suppose the mind to be, as we say, white paper, void of all characters, without any ideas. How comes it to be furnished? Whence comes it by that vast store? To this I answer in one word, from experience, in that all our knowledge is founded, and from that it ultimately derives itself." Close quote. Are there no innate ideas? Does the mind lack capacities and powers of its own, being etched exclusively by sensory inputs? Locke apparently thought so, with only a few disclaimers so wispy they were abandoned by his standard bearers almost at once. Are minds blank like white paper, capable of accepting writing from whoever possesses the ink? Empty like a gas tank or a sugar bowl, to be filled by anyone who can locate the filler hole? Was John Watson right when he said in 1930, quote, "Give me a dozen healthy infants, well-formed, and my own specified world to bring them up in, and I'll guarantee to take anyone at random and train him to become any type of specialist I might select, doctor, lawyer, artist, merchant chief, and yes, even beggar man and thief, regardless of his talents, his pensions, tendencies, abilities, vocation, and the race of his ancestors," close quote. Do you find something attractive in that presumption of plasticity in human nature? So did Joseph Stalin and Chairman Mao, two of the century's foremost applied behaviorists on the grand scale. Taylorism sought to manage by the control of physical movements and environments, but the behaviorists wanted more certainty than that. They wanted to control the inner life, too. A great many reflective analyses have placed our own two Roosevelt presidents in the same broad category. The trouble in school arises from disagreement about what life is for. If we believe human beings have no unique personal essence, this question is meaningless. But even then, you can't get rid of the idea easily. Life commands your answer. You cannot refuse because your actions write your answer large for everyone to see, even if you don't see it yourself. As you regard human nature, you will teach. Or as someone else regards it, you will teach. There aren't any third ways. Is human nature empty? If it is, who claims the right to fill it? In such circumstances, what can school mean? If ever a situation was capable of revealing the exquisite power of metaphor to control our lives, this must be it. Are children empty? As helpless infants and dependent youth, we lay exposed to the metaphors of our guardians. They colonize our spirit. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. Among structural engineers, the terms plastic and elastic describe propensities of material. These are concepts which can also be brought to bear on the question whether human nature is built out of accidents of experience or whether there is some divine inner spark in all of us that makes each person unique and self-determining. As you decide, the schools which march forward from your decision are predestined. Immanuel Kant thought both conditions possible, a strong continuous effort of will tipping the balance. In structural engineering, implications of the original builder-creator's decision are inescapable. Constructions like bridges and skyscrapers do have an inner nature, given them by the materials chosen and the shapes imposed, an integrity long experience has allowed us to profile. The structure will defend this integrity, resisting wind stress, for example, which threatens to change its shape permanently. When stress increases dangerously, as it would in a hurricane, the building material becomes elastic, surrendering part of its integrity temporarily to protect the rest, compromising to save its total character in the long run. When the wind abates, the urge to resume the original shape becomes dominant, and the bridge or building relaxes back to normal. A human analogy is that we remember who we are in school even when coerced to act like somebody else. In engineering, this integrity of memory is called elastic behavior. Actors practice deliberate elasticity, and the Chechens or Hmong express remarkable group elasticity. After violent stresses abate, they remember who they are. But another road exists. To end unbearable stress, material has a choice of surrendering its memory. Under continued stress, material can become plastic, losing its elasticity and changing its shape permanently. Watch your own kids as their schooling progresses. Are they like Chechens with a fierce personal integrity and an inner resilience? Or under the stress of the social laboratory of schooling, have they become plastic over time, kids you hardly recognize, kids who've lost their original integrity? In the collapse of a bridge or building in high wind, a decisive turning point is reached when the structure abandons its nature and becomes plastic. Trained observers can tell when elasticity is fading because prior to the moment of collapse, the structure cannot regain its original shape. It loses its spirit, taking on new and unexpected shapes in a struggle to resist further change. When this happens, it is wordlessly crying, help me," just as so many kids did in all the schools in which I ever taught. The most important task I assigned myself as a school teacher was helping kids regain their integrity, but I lost many, their desperate last-ditch resistance giving way, their integrity shattering before my horrified eyes. Look back in memory at your kids before first grade, then fast forward to seventh. Have they disintegrated into warring fragments divided against themselves? Don't believe anyone who tells you that's natural human development. If there are no absolutes, as pragmatists like Dewey assert, then human nature must be plastic. Then the spirit can be successfully deformed from its original shape, and we will have no sanctuary in which to resist institutional stamping. The Deweys further assert that human nature processed this way is able to perform efficiently what is asked of it later on by society. Escaping our original identity will actually improve most of us, they say. This is the basic hypothesis of utopia building, that the structure of personhood can be broken and reformed again and again for the better. Plasticity is the base on which scientific psychology must stand if it is to be prescriptive. And if not prescriptive, who needs it? Finding an aggressive, instrumental psychology associated with schooling is a sure sign empty child attitudes aren't far away. The notion of empty children has origins predating psychology, of course. But the most important engine reshaping American schools into socialization laboratories after Wundt was the widely publicized work of Russian physiologist Ivan Pavlov, 1849 to 1936, who had been a student of Wundt at Leipzig. Pavlov won the Nobel in 1904, credited with discovering the conditioned reflex, whereby systems of physical function thought to be fixed biologically, like the salivation of dogs, could be rewired to irrelevant outside stimuli, like bells ringing. This had immense influence on the spread of behavioral psychology into government agencies and corporate boardrooms. For it seemed to herald the discovery of master wiring diagrams which could eventually bring the entire population under control of physiological psychology. Pavlov became the most prestigious ally of the behavioral enterprise with his Nobel. His text, The Conditioned Reflexes of 1926, provided a sacred document to be waved at skeptics, and his Russian nationality aided immeasurably, harmonizing well with the long romance American intellectuals had with the Soviet Union. Even today, Pavlov is a name to conjure with. Russian revolutionary experimentation allowed the testing of what was possible to go much further and faster than could have happened in America and Western Europe. Notions of emptiness turned the pedestrian problem of basic skills schooling into the complex political question of which outside agencies with particular agendas to impose will be allowed to write the curriculum. And there are nuances. For instance, the old-fashioned idea of an empty container suggests a hollow to be filled, an approach not unfamiliar to people who went to school before 1960. But plastic emptiness is a different matter. It might lead to an armory of tricks designed to fix, distract, and motivate the subject to cooperate in its own transformation, the new style commonly found in public schools after 1960. The newer style has given rise to an intricately elaborated theory of incentives capable of assisting managers to work their agenda on the managed. Only a few years ago, almost every public school teacher in the country had to submit a list of classroom motivation employed to be inspected by school managers. Conceptions of emptiness to be filled as the foundation metaphor of schooling are not confined to hollowness and plasticity, but also include theories of mechanism. De La Mettrie's Man a Machine, Vision from the Enlightenment, for instance, is evidence of an idea regularly recurring for millennia. If we are mechanisms, we must be predetermined, as Calvin said. Then the whole notion of education is nonsensical. There is no independent inner essence to be drawn forth and developed. Only adjustments are possible, and if the contraption doesn't work right, it should be junked. Everything important about machinery is superficial. The notion of machine emptiness has been the master theory of human nature since the beginning of the 19th century. It still takes turns in curriculum formation with theories of vegetable emptiness, plastic emptiness, systems emptiness, and from time to time, some good old-fashioned Lockean blank sheet emptiness. Nobody writes curriculum for self-determined spiritual individuals and expects to sell it in the public school market. This hardline empiricism descends to us most directly from Locke and Hume, who both said mind lacks capacities and powers of its own. It has no innate contents. Everything etched there comes from simple sense impressions mixed and compounded. This chilly notion was greatly refined by the French ideologues, who thought the world so orderly and mechanical the future course of history could be predicted on the basis of the position and velocity of molecules. For these men, the importance of human agency vanished entirely. With Napoleon, these ideas were given global reach a few years later. So seductive is this mechanical worldview, it has proven itself immune to damage by facts which contradict it. And I've been reading from The Underground History of American Education, by John Taylor Gatto. John Taylor Gatto spent 30 years as a public school teacher in New York, then left the profession as he became convinced it was destroying the minds of children rather than developing them as it claimed to be doing. This work, The Underground History of American Education, is a result of 10 years of research into the history and purposes and influences on modern compulsory education. And you can download the entire book online and find out more about Gatto's work at his website, johntaylorgatto.com. That's Gatto with two T's. And you can download an MP3 of this and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests at our website, unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.